Yeah, so, you know, I thought it was something good, but apparently it was not an artifact.
Not an artifact.
No.
What was it?
Well, it was one of those tabs that you actually pull completely off the beer can.
Oh, pop top.
You remember those?
Vaguely.
You pull it, the whole thing off, yeah. And you could, yeah.
So that's what it was? Yeah, well, I guess it's
doing a little metal detecting and...
It's an artifact of a good night.
Yeah, but it wasn't anything.
It wasn't worth anything?
No.
Did
no,
you put it, did you try putting excited. It on eBay?
No.
Because people will buy anything on eBay. This you know what I bought on eBay? Oh, wait a minute. Hold on a second. We're rolling.
All right, well then let's roll. I'm Rich.
And I'm Mark.
And we are
two guys on
Block Island.
What shall we do?
All right, listeners, we have a guest here with us today. His name is Kevin McBride. He is a professor of anthropology at the University of Connecticut. Did I say that right?
Well done.
I got it all out? Okay, good. Those are some long words for a guy like me. So, Kevin, we have you here because you've done some work on Block Island, but maybe we could start off with... what was your first trip to Block Island? Was it pleasure? Was it work? And how did you get out there?
It was work. at the time, the Historical Society there, and I don't know if you know Jerry Abbott, he had become, you know, the president. They were looking for an archaeologist to, you know, do some survey work, identify native sites, and they had some funding, and they, I don't know how they found me. And they asked me to come out and take a look to see if I'd be interested.
About what time are we talking here? What year would give or take?
83.
Okay.
84.
Can I be honest, too? I'm not quite sure how we found you either. I don't know. But we'll get to that later.
I heard his name so many times from other, you know, people who like to find things on the island, you know, from times
I remember
by.
You telling me about it quite a while ago, but then I was like, I forgot. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. So I found him, and boy, is he glad I did. Okay, sorry to interrupt.
Sorry.
So, yeah.
So I just never left. It's an amazing place. I mean, you know that, but what you may not know is it's an amazing place archaeologically as well, historically, in terms of native sites, native history that, you know, date back 12,000 years, at least. So it's a remarkable place. We've learned a lot. There's things that are happened on Block Island in terms of native history that you don't see anywhere else.
Like what?
They're kind of unique. Just their overall way of life, life ways.
Kind of like today. Different, you know.
It's a good analogy.
You know, we
know what happens if you stay on an island long enough.
Yeah.
And
we're just another town in Rhode Island, but yet we're not.
Right.
You know, some differences there.
So I actually do think the native people out there were different, not in a weird or odd way, but, you know, there were people apart. They were separated. Not that they didn't go back and forth to the mainland a lot, but I think some of the patterns we see out there are unique to Block Island.
Really?
Okay. Did they usually fly or take the ferry?
If it was good weather, they would fly.
Yeah, smart. Yeah.
On peyote or something. Maybe. Yeah.
But they were in just canoes, or what, were they rowing over there?
When they had canoes. They had these massive.
Like outrigger kind of things like the Hawaiians had?
Not outriggers, but they were big. They were like 80 feet long.
Oh.
And they could hold 40 people.
Oh, wow.
And they had a unique design. They had these beaks or prows at both ends that jutted out from the ends.
Is this where the double-ender came from?
Well, it might have a similar...
Is there a
connection? I don't think it's a connection, but it might have a similar history to it in that both vessels are easy. No matter what end, you can beach them and take right off.
Yeah.
But these prows were mostly to cut the water, the waves. And they had a small keel to help them in the rougher water. These guys go back and forth all the time.
So this is sort of like the difference between a you hear the term, I don't kayak, but there's a kayak and then there's an ocean kayak that's built more for the surf and the ocean. So these canoes were more prepared for that purpose, to not be used on a pond or a lake.
They were designed for rough water as opposed to smaller dugout canoes that, you know, for still water, for calm water.
And did they, were they But they weren't hollowed out of a log. They were.
They were.
They were.
They would. They would. You know, get a large tree, and of course, you know, back in the day, there were some pretty large,
good sized trees. Yeah,
and they would burn the middle out down to maybe an inch thick on the sides. And, you know, carefully tend. It takes a while to burn these out. You got to tend the fire. You got to be careful. Native people still do it today.
They burned it down to an inch. They didn't get it down to like 3 or 4 and then carve the rest out. Both, there was a little
both.
Bit of that.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. A bit of both. But they always had to be, you know, if you watch them making them today, the Wampanoag still make them. It's a 24-hour job and you can't, you can't walk away from the process.
And then how long does it take to burn out a canoe?
Something that
big. That was my next question.
Probably a week.
Really? Oh, wow. Because it's a slow very burn. Very slow yeah. burn. Yeah.
And is,
yeah.
I wonder if there was a, like, it was it just easier than, like, or was it tools that they didn't have that made them do it that's how it originated doing it? Like, I'm thinking, why wouldn't you just break out your hammer and your chisel and just start chiseling away? But now I'm thinking maybe they didn't have a hammer and chisel.
They did.
Well, they did.
But it's easier to chip charcoal than it is, you know, raw wood.
Oh, so maybe it was an on and off thing. They would burn.
Chip, burn. You know,
cut. Hey, Larry, I want to chip today. I don't want to be a burner.
Yeah. You know, I'm up sick all night of the chipping. Ah, come on, man. I smell my clothes smell like smoke.
But I guess you had time on your hands back then.
I know. What else were you going to do? Yeah. Hunt, gather.
That's pretty cool. Do you think they got trees that big on Block Island? Was there ever a forest? Do you think? I mean, I don't
they
know.
May have.
I don't ever want to hit you with a question that you're supposed to know every single answer to.
Well, I mean, here's the deal. I'm an archaeologist. I make stuff up all the time.
Excellent.
So
you're going to fit
right in.
You're
not
right
going to know. You're just not going to know.
Do you know, sidebar, we randomly, Katie and I watched Raiders of the Lost Ark last night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Typical day for me.
Do you really?
Oh, yeah.
Is it like one of your, it's got to be one of your favorite movies,
oh, yeah,
right?
It's great. Great movie.
Yeah.
Great movie.
It's an all-time classic.
Top 10 for sure.
Let me ask you this. You say thousands of years. What do you figure the timetable is on? So I've been told, and I believe, that Block Island was formed by glacial erosion type thing, where glaciers came down and slid, but they spared this one little piece of land that, you know, used to be, that's how far southern Connecticut and Rhode Island went.
It was glacially formed, but not so much eroding as depositing. So
okay.
When the glaciers were coming down from the north and pushing all kinds of debris in front of them, when they stopped and when they were melting at the same rate they were growing, they just spewed a lot of debris, rock, sand, in place. And Cape Cod, Long Island, Block Island, Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket were all formed by that same process.
Wow.
And so,
it was like a glacier carrying buckets of dirt and then dropping it.
Yep. Yeah. And dropping
it. I don't know where I got the carve thing. It might be from the.
Well, they did do that. If they went over bedrock, they'd carve it out. That's where a lot of debris came from, is them carving out, you know, bedrock cliffs or boulders. And then, you know, they'd break up, they'd get water worn, they'd eventually, you know, get deposited.
So, wow. when do the first people show up in the area here, recorded history wise?
Well, that's the $1 million question.
Okay,
so
I've only got like $30
because it's not recorded. That's the it's deciphering it's through recorded. Science,
right?
You know,
well, we used to think it was a pretty nice, neat package story.
Yeah,
it came over 12,000-13,000 years ago over the Bering Land Bridge. Sea level drops, exposing vast areas of the continental shelf, 300 sea level, 300 feet lower. And it is the case that contemporary Native Americans, genetically, morphologically, have their closest affinity to, you know, North Central Asians. But as they've discovered, that wasn't the whole story. And the evidence now suggests that people were making their way into the Western Hemisphere from a number of different routes. And the dates of some of these sites are going back 15, 20, 25,000.
Huh.
Maybe earlier?
In the U.S.
In the U.S.
And where do they know where they were coming from? They don't know where they were coming from.
Well, they have a sense of some. One theory is, you know, aside from the Bering Bridge, you know, that works.
That's up in that's the Alaska on the Bering Sea. Okay. Yeah.
And then, but you can't get people into the Western Hemisphere real early from that route. So they now think that it was one avenue was a coastal migration from, you know, Western Pacific up the Asian coast, around the Aleutians, Japan, and then sort of down. That could have gotten you here pretty early.
Wow. That's requires, a hike.
It's a hike. Well, you
it's
know,
a hike now.
Yeah. I wouldn't think of it as migration. It's more people doing their normal things and just slowly moving, pushing.
Gotcha.
And they eventually
crept that way.
Yeah, because, here. You know, if I'm not mistaken, they would, their way of disposing of waste and natural stuff was to, you know, you did your thing in an area and then you just pick up
move and to the next one.
You'd move a few miles one way or the other to, and you know.
Is that right? That's how it was.
Or if someone's behind you, you keep moving too. I mean, people avoid confrontation.
Yeah.
And you just move. And it was probably a combination.
Tell that to some of the people at Captain Nick's on a Friday night.
We try. We're like, can you just move on?
Can you not dump your drink on that guy's head, sir? Sorry.
Interesting.
Yeah. So then let's bring it back to Block Island.
Okay.
So how do we get to, I mean, we spoke with Pat McCobb at length. You know, he gave us a pretty good, you know, idea of what was going on. But, you know, when refresh our memories, what's the earliest?
Well, you know, here's the deal. So we know that there's stuff on Block Island, stuff meaning evidence of people or at least animals, 12,000.
Yeah.
But at the time, 12,000, Block Island would have been a very high promontory because the sea level was 300 feet lower than it is today, right?
Oh.
Uh-huh. So if you're looking out from Block Island, you would have to walk 100 miles to get to the coastline.
Yeah.
So all of that area, the continental shelf, was in theory available for human habitation and animals. We do know there's animals out there because of scallop fishermen always dragging stuff up.
Yeah.
They have occasionally dredged up some artifacts that are pretty old.
Like what? I never even thought a scallop boat would be.
Spear points. They've gotten mastodon, mammoth skulls, tusks. I've seen walrus, pelvis. I've seen, you know, so, spear points.
And what? I'm.
Did
so
you
lost.
Ever hear about the Black Ness monster? Did you hear about this thing years ago?
Black Ness.
Block Ness. Oh, Block Ness. They were calling it the Block Ness monsters.
No, I didn't.
Something. It was like my first summer again, like '96, right? Mid '90s. Some fisherman pulled up the skeleton of something.
Wow.
I think it was actually flesh on it, too. This was still alive, but it was something nobody had ever seen before.
Yeah.
It was a really weird looking.
They said it was like maybe a sturgeon, a giant sturgeon, but whatever. It was weird. No one knew what it was. And then they put it in a freezer and it mysteriously disappeared overnight.
Yeah, the government took it, I'm pretty sure.
I don't know. This was X-Files times.
So what do you think preserved these? Like a mammoth skull. So you're telling me that some artifacts are found by fishing boats dragging, like draggers. They would drag up these things. So what is it, just a combination of how it was laying on the bottom and the salt water?
Yeah,
and
it's luck. I mean, draggers don't go too deep, so it's got to be something relatively close to the surface, a few feet.
Yeah.
It's chance, probably.
Wow.
And there's probably a lot of things they found they don't tell anybody.
Yeah.
And
like what?
Same kind of stuff.
They just don't
scallop.
Or
are,
suddenly they are afraid someone's going to shut down that fishing ground.
Exactly. Wait, finish your sentence. Scallopers are
They're very, for the same reason, they're very
protective.
Gotcha. Yeah.
You don't want the, you know, like this year, for an example, there was talk of limiting the speed of all navigation vessels during the winter season because of right whales.
Oh, you know,
it's an endangered species thing, so it's a little bit different. But the point is, the government was trying to step in, and you know, and the Block Island ferry would take an hour and a half instead of an hour to get to Block Island.
If they did that.
They ended up not making it happen. But so they just would say, "Don't let's just brush this one under the rug. We don't need anybody coming and investigating these waters."
Huh. I thought you meant because you could sell the artifacts for money, and that's illegal.
They could,
right? Because I know these, like, there are collectors. People collect.
Oh yeah,
there are some
collectors out there.
Yeah, is it legal to buy a woolly mammoth head?
Yeah.
But if you find one, are you obligated? Or are you supposed to notify somebody? Just find your ski.
You know, I guess it depends where they find it. If it's in a marine sanctuary, perhaps the government owns it, or something like that. But for the most part, it's, you know, if it's on private property, it's, you know, if you have permission.
Yeah. And on Block Island, if you are building a house, and now we were talking about it a little bit earlier, Rich and I, before you came, do you have to have the site checked for artifacts before you dig, or obviously you're going to start digging, or is it only certain areas on Block Island where they require that? Or is it like, if you start digging and find something, then they come in and...
If the boundary of your lot is within 200 feet of the coastline, that'll kick in a coastal management assessment and usually requires an archaeological survey.
Yeah.
Okay. So... You said something. So, all right, let's go with this question. Are there certain areas of Block Island that were more known to be more densely populated? You know, I think Pat Cobb said certain areas were known to be like the hot spots for the villages of the natives there.
I think the around the salt ponds, but not exclusively so. I mean, we've learned a lot about the Block Island native history in the last 30 years, and you know, pleasantly, or maybe not so pleasantly, realize that what we thought we knew is wrong.
Really?
So we reassess, we recently did a survey of the entire coast, 40 miles of Block Island's coastline, for a Storm Sandy assessment.
Yeah.
To see which coastal sites, you know, were eroding from bluffs or wherever, and we found 160 new sites. And when we combined what we knew from those with the existing body of data,
which was how many sites did you already know about?
Probably 150.
Wow. So you more than, in that one study, you more than doubled the amount of sites that you were aware of.
I Black Island probably had the highest native population density of any place in the region.
Okay. So when we say sites, are we talking now, would this be like a family, you know, like people own homes? Would they have their, did they stay in teepees? I'm sorry, I don't mean to be so.
Wigwams.
Wigwams, that's a
typical type structure. But
so what is it, when we say a site, is that like one family site, or is that like a small tribe, or like...
It varies. A site is a pretty generic term for any place that yields human activity. Sorry about the definition, but...
No,
that's good.
So
that's
they can be villages, they can be single family.
That's what I was... Yeah, that's
what I plant gathering place, you know, as long as there's evidence that people are there doing something, it's a site.
Gotcha.
Now, like, for example, one area I noticed you digging was, and I think you were out there for this, was they were putting in, I think they either had to replace or repair the water line going to the town beach, and it goes in front of Twin Maples there. Yep. So I noticed you guys, now, was something found that triggered that, and then it was reported, and that, does that put a hold for a little while? Is it a courtesy thing, or do you just say, look, this is how it is. We get it for a couple of weeks to go through it.
Certainly not courtesy. The project you're mentioning, I didn't have anything to do with that. My colleagues did, which, you know, we always share information. We visit, and, you know, great. They found some great stuff, but usually in a situation like that, any project that requires a federal or state permit or funding is going to kick in an archaeological survey. And if it's a private property owner, if they're building something within 200 feet of the coast, that kicks in survey as well. So these areas are checked before construction begins.
Yeah.
And if something is found, then more intensive work takes place to see if it's important. And if it is important, then there's an excavation that, you know, to save the data, the information.
Yeah.
Is the theory.
Does it eventually get given back then? Is it like sort of an all clear? Okay, we're done. You can you can now do what you got to do.
Is there ever like a case of like eminent domain where they're like, oh, this is a burial ground. You can't like do this there. Although who the hell wants to build a house on an Indian burial ground? But does that happen? Or
did you see Poltergeist?
Sure. I did. That's why I was asked.
It happens. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So like the guy, wow, that would suck. Imagine on a piece of land and you're like,
well, I mean, some people are okay with it because they feel...
I'd be okay with it.
It's because, okay, we're going to be the caretakers. We're just going to make sure that, you know, nothing else happens. And
yeah, I'm just thinking, like, if I spent half a mil on, like, you know, a lot on Block Island, I'm like, well, is my life savings?
I don't think you'd find a half a million.
I mean, look, I'd follow the rules and, you know, respect. Obviously, but I'm just thinking.
It gets tricky if there are burials involved.
Yeah. Because
then you have to, and they would anyway, the Narragansetts would be what they call a consulting party. They would be involved in the reviewing the project, monitoring the project. Nobody wants to find burials. No one wants to have anything to do with them because it creates, you know, legal and technical and logistical problems. But it's also, you know,
well, spiritually. I mean, I mean, forget all that.
It's
like
traumatic.
Someone's burial. You know,
traumatic for the tribe.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, they make the cute names for the house on Black Island. What's yours called? Bad Juju.
Not bad. Sachem's neck. Sachem's head neck. You know.
Sachem.
Sachem's head neck.
What is this?
What is that?
It's where they hold the weddings. Where's the, you know, across from the state beach, there's like a big hill.
Sullivan houses. Sullivan.
And the name of that land is Sachem's Head Neck.
That's what they called it, apparently, the first settlers.
I did not know that.
They went there and saw a couple of skulls, native skulls, that had been put on posts by, you know, the Manasseans. And
now, all right. I was born and raised calling Sacampan, but it's actually pronounced Sachem.
It's actually Chagum, and it's not Sachem. It's actually, there's an actual guy, his name is Chagum.
Who's this guy?
He was a Narragansett, and he lived on Block Island for a while. I'm going to get this a little screwed up. But
fits our style.
Good.
Yeah.
My kind of guys.
Yeah. We're really messed up.
He eventually, so there is, as you know, there is an indigenous presence on Block Island even today. And, you know, he was there with his family, and I think they just, he lived in that area. And he eventually left, and he, along with other indigenous people or mixed African indigenous people, established a community up in a place called Bark Hampstead State Forest in northwestern Connecticut called the Lighthouse, they called it.
Yep.
So that was not an uncommon thing to do, is for native people who were getting disenfranchised from their land to sort of pick up and gather some families and establish new communities somewhere else. That's what happened, I think, with him.
Wow.
Kind of like, you know what? Screw you guys, I'm out, is basically what eventually happens.
Wow.
Can't deal with this anymore.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I mean, it's...
Yeah.
It's still happening.
At what, you know, again, if we know, we know. So I'm assuming the term caveman is not a proper terminology for a period of time, but because there were no caves on Block Island. Well, first off, I'm gathering now that I know this about the ocean, Block Island must have been, at the time when the sea was much lower, must have been almost like a mountain. Like,
exactly.
Yeah. You know, so that was a high point of that 100 miles you spoke of. So
you could see a long way. So
it was a safe place.
If there were people here earlier than 12,000, and evidence suggests that there were, not easy to find, they're out on the continental shelf. And they're now underwater.
Yeah.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. So At what point do in terminology does it transfer? What is the proper term for a pre-native? Is it, or is it all just one? It's just the time period that they were in.
Like, they call it pre-Clovis.
Pre-Clovis. What around how far back is pre-Clovis, give or take?
Well, stay tuned. 30 years ago, if you had that asked that question, 95% of the archaeologists would say it's BS. There is no native sites before Clovis. And Clovis refers to a very distinctive stone cultural tradition with very distinctive spear points. Same all across the United States. They're, you know, the same assemblage, the same forms. That was the standard. And people believe that if anybody claimed any sites were earlier, you were nuts. And literally they would be, you know, laughed off the stage or the podium, whatever. But, you know, in the last 30 years, there's overwhelming evidence that people were here pretty early. And collectively, they call those people pre-Clovis.
Pre-Clovis. What was some of this evidence that has made it overwhelmingly clear?
You know, tools, extinct animal bones. And
that they
sites.
Hadn't seen before, the likes of before.
They'd seen them, but because there was such scrutiny with any claimed pre-Clovis sites, you had to have all your T's crossed, your I's dotted. There can't be any disturbance in the site, no mixing. The radiocarbonates have to be spot on. All kinds of criteria.
Kind of like, I mean, a forensic crime scene, basically. Exactly. You can't disturb the evidence. Wow. Yeah. And how accurate is carbon dating to the point of, like, you know, where you could make that call and say, this is Clovis, this is pre-Clovis? Like, how many years are we talking between what you consider Clovis and pre-Clovis?
Not long. I mean,
50 years, 100, 1,000?
Well, that's a good question. We don't know. We don't know when the earliest Clovis site was.
Yeah.
Where it originated. We think it actually might have originated the culture on the east coast, eastern part of the United States.
Where were these artifacts found, the new ones?
The Clovis?
Yeah. The pre-Clovis. Oh. The ones that have, like, kind of expanded the...
Well, you're not going to find them in New England because we're a clean slate. Glacier just wiped everything clean.
Right.
There are probably some out on the continental shelf, and some scallopers have dredged up some really early spear points that are clearly like 25,000-ish.
Wow. So these are coming from the bottom of the ocean somewhere out there.
But they're also found on the terrestrial landscape all over the United States.
They are, okay.
Every day there's new ones being found.
Oh, let's not forget that bottom of the ocean was once Island. So, you know, I know my wife found a point, and I think it was actually shown to you. I think Pat Cobb borrowed it, and the comment was, you know, that's pretty old for Block Island. You know, typically you wouldn't find this type of point on Block Island. They had been finding them as out in Virginia, or, you know, as you went further west, you had to go further west to find these, and here was one on Block Island. So, you know, that's it.
I mean, there's early stuff here.
So about, you know, when did they start to become considered the Native people and the tribe type mentality? About how many, like, thousands of years ago?
I mean, that's a really good question. So basically, tribal formation, when does that happen? When did people begin to consolidate into larger communities and, you know, greater numbers? I would say Black Island's tricky because some of the earliest dated village sites, year-round village sites, are the earliest are on Block Island.
Wow.
So 2,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago, I think we start to see this process on Block Island. It takes another several hundred or 1,000 years for the mainland to catch up, I think.
Okay.
And a lot of that had to do with the fact that Block Island, is, you guys know and most of your listeners know, is one of the richest ecosystems in the region. I mean, it creates its own ecosystem.
Yeah.
Because of the northern and southern currents meeting at Block Island, plus the bathymetry around Block Island. It's highly variable. It's great for all different kinds of fish. And So that's why I think there was a higher population density of Native people on Block Island than anywhere else, just because of the richness of the resources.
So what you're saying is, at one point, Block Island was actually ahead of the mainland in terms of, you know, you're welcome, mainland. It only took 2,000 years for you to,
or 10,000, whatever. You know,
pretty much.
So, wow.
So we speak of tribes. We have the Narragansett, the Manasseean. So straighten me out a little bit. Are those distinctly different tribes that were in the area?
Yeah. So, I mean, not that they weren't closely related.
Yeah.
No, I understand, but they were
intermarried. And, but they were distinct entities, social, political entities.
And throughout time, was there a dominant tribe that dominated Block Island?
Yeah, probably an ebb and flow. The Narragansetts, by the 1600s, we know the Narragansetts sort of controlled Block Island and most of the Rhode Island coastline. Pequots did for a while. And, you know, the Manassees were one of many groups along the shores of, you know, southern New England who interacted, made war, made peace, grew stuff.
Traded things.
Traded a lot of things, yep.
So this, you know, should we take a break for our sponsors?
Yeah, let's do a sponsor break.
We're going to do a quick break and listen to our sponsors. So stay tuned there, listeners, and we'll be right back.
Hey, Rich.
Yeah?
I am starving right now. So I want to go somewhere that's intimate, but has really great food and kind of a fun atmosphere. So you know what? I think I'm going to head down to Eli's.
Well, they got to be doing it right. They've been there since 1994.
Yeah. And well, you know, a big part of it is because Chef Erica is always there and she's making some of the greatest dishes on this island.
Oh, they got some real island favorites in my book. The tuna nachos, the arugula salad with warm goat cheese. Oh, how can you go wrong?
Totally. And you know what's really cool is that the dishes are crafted with fresh local ingredients.
Yeah. And the menu, you know, it changes too. They have exciting seasonal changes to the menu. So, you know, what you find on there in the spring, it'll be different by the fall.
Yeah. And they're always great no matter what there. But hey, you know what I really love doing is sitting at the bar because they have an amazing wine list. And when Rosemary's bartending, she makes a Rosarita, if you know what I'm saying. Uh-huh. And she also, Rich, here's one of the things she does. She makes martinis with just the right amount of ice shavings floating on the top.
Oh, I love that sheen, you know. Along with partners Brad and Ann Marthens, Eli's features a warm, friendly staff of local island service industry veterans, and they're there and they're going to make sure that your experience is absolutely perfect.
And they've got an extended season, March to November, and then they open back up for New Year's.
Yeah, I've been there for New Year's. It's fun.
Cool.
So, but they don't take reservations, so you will notice, because it's so great, there's a line out the door.
Yeah, I'm going to check the menu first online at elisblockisland.com.
Cooler?
Check.
Ice?
Check.
Drinks?
Check.
That's everything.
All right, let's head down to Fishworks.
All right, I'm excited for this trip.
I am too. And you know what's cool about Fishworks is, I mean, hey, today we're going to go out and try and catch some striped bass, right? But you can get bluefish, fluke, sea bass, bonito, whatever's in season.
Yeah, you can book a light tackle or fly fishing morning charter with Captain Chris for up to 3 people.
Right. Oh, wait a minute. I invited some friends, so we might have to go out on the Harley with Captain Hank because they do half trips and full day trips for up to 6 people.
Oh, and Captain Hank is a hoot. And, of course, the shop, you know, the Fishworks Tackle Shop, they have everything you need, including pointers. If you don't want to go on a charter, they can sell you what you need, tell you where to go and how to do it.
Yeah, totally. I think I might pick up a hat and a T-shirt, too, because their merchandise is so on point.
Yeah, good-looking stuff. They're located at 40 Ocean Avenue, and they're open every day in season, and great merchandise.
They really do have some cool stuff. And if you want to check it out online, you can purchase all year long at www.bifishworks.com.
All right.
How cool is that?
Ah, I love it.
All right. Let's go catch some fish. Hey, Rich, do these bell bottoms make me look fat?
Bell bottom? Oh, wait. It must be Monday and you're going to disco night at Captain Nick's.
Well, yeah, of course I'm going to disco night at Captain Nick's. I'm the DJ, man. I got to be there.
That place is so much fun.
So much fun. And the fun doesn't end after Monday because on Tuesday and Wednesdays, we have dueling pianos followed by Dr. Wes Chesterton's Sloppy Seconds.
What are Sloppy Seconds?
Well, that's when I play the piano for the rest of the drunk people there at the end of the night.
Oh, that sounds fun in itself. And Thursdays, they've got live acoustic acts and full bands and DJs.
Yeah. And Friday and Saturday afternoons, we have acoustic acts on the Deck at 5:30. Fridays are Delaney, and then Saturdays are buddy Rob Davis.
And then Friday and Saturday nights, they've got the best live bands on Block Island, like Derek and the Fun Bags, the Blushing Brides, Fever, Neil and the Vipers, West End Blend, and the High and Mighty Brass Band, just to name a few.
Yeah, and the bands aren't over just because Friday and Saturday night ends. On Sunday afternoons, the Young Guns take the stage on the Deck at 5:30.
Sunday Fun Day, and what if you're hungry? They got food, right?
Yeah, for sure.
All right, so they've served food out of the Captain Galley 7 days a week, including some late night grub. So, you know, if you're hungry, stop in late night and grab a bite.
Yeah, and if you want to check out the full entertainment schedule, let's just head over to CaptainNicksBI.com. So I was just on the beach and saw Rich hanging 10 on a super cool surfboard rental from Diamond Blue Surf Shop. It's definitely the place to go for all your surfboard, paddleboard, and beach rental needs. But don't forget, Diamond Blue used to rent their stuff down on the beach, but this year you can go right to the shop for your rentals, where you'll also find the sweetest selection of swimsuits, hats, t-shirts, sandals, and other fun beach accessories. Be sure to check out their new line of Knockaround sunglasses. Knockaround is a super small, quality company that features polarized shades for under $40. They're available in tons of bright, fun colors and styles, so if you're looking for shades that are stylish, affordable, and fun, Diamond Blue can hook you up with a pair of Knockarounds and get you back out in the sun in no time. But don't forget to take care of that skin and put your sunscreen on. You don't have sunscreen? No worries, brah. Diamond Blue now features Vacation brand sunscreen. Based in Miami, Florida, Vacation sunscreen will let you spend all day on the beach without ever have to worrying about getting burnt. One of the greatest things about Diamond Blue is their owner and staff. Jen has owned and operated Diamond Blue for years now, and she only hires the most helpful, friendly crew of peeps who are filled to the brim with knowledge about all of Diamond Blue's fantastic products. Diamond Blue always has a ton of product, and there are even great deals to be found on last season's stuff. So get your buns in the sun and head down to Diamond Blue Surf Shop.
So here's a question that... So did the Native Americans on Block Island, they seem to talk about, I've heard, you know, oysters and clams and all that was a part of their life, but the salt pond hadn't been formed for quite some time because that, like, that's where we know to go get oysters and clams and everything. So, I mean, I just don't understand the timing on these Native American groups that live there, and did they just get them on the shoreline, you know, off the beach? Is probably what happened.
Probably not sandy beaches, but you actually pointed out a very important ecological development.
Good job, Rich. Nice work, buddy.
All right, let's hear it.
You're smart.
So the salt pond was originally a freshwater body of water, and with rising sea level, it was inundated probably about 3,000 years ago or so. That created... the Great Salt Pond is not a pond. It's classified as an estuary. It's not like the ponds on mainland Narragansett.
Refresh my memory on an estuary. I should know that, too.
It's a deeper body of water that's constantly flushed with fresh water. And it's deep enough and rich enough in resources that fish will spawn there. Sturgeon. All kinds of things.
Gotcha. Yeah, like stripers... always go, you'll catch them in rivers at a certain time of year because they're going up there to spawn.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
They're going to the Great Salt Pond to spawn.
Yeah.
And
them and a bunch of frat guys from New Jersey.
Well, that's only on weekends.
Only on the weekends, though.
And so those kinds of muddy bottomed, sandy bottom waters support a lot of shellfish. And we do find in these sites a lot of shellfish. It's a little misleading because there's so much shell, you think it was the dominant food source.
Yeah. You got to eat a lot of clams.
You got to eat a lot of clams. If you look at the meat yield of one clam, it takes how many hundreds or thousands to meet the calories of a deer or something like that. You know?
Right.
But they serve a purpose for archaeologists because they, the calcium acts as a... to counteract the acidic soils on the terrestrial part.
Oh,
everything's preserved. The bone is preserved in native sites. Huh. And so they're
good. So it plays a role. Their garbage pile of the clamshells would play a role in preserving things left in that site.
Garbage is really what it's all about for an archaeologist. It's you are what you eat.
Did they make...
Someday they're going to dig up a giant Twinkie when they find me.
Yeah. They're going to find a bunch of like McDonald's wrappers. Yeah,
probably.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Did they use the clamshells ever for tools or did they make things?
They did. They did make hoes, agricultural hoes sometimes. Yeah. They could use them to cut things. They could use them to... They'd crush them to make as temper for pottery. Yeah. You know, if they're large enough, they could be used for little, you know, cups or.
Yeah.
But they made beads, wampum eventually. Yep. So they had a lot of uses. I think mostly it was a food source, but you know, any marine shell with its whiteness, its reflectiveness. Its positiveness is a really important object or being. You know, it's got those qualities.
Yeah.
So, this is why wampum was, you know, so important. Why shell beads are so important.
Like where the inside of the shell goes from like white to purple to blue. It's actually, if you think about it, it's the only place in nature you find that. You're not going to just see anything out in the woods that's, you know, white and purple and pink. That makes sense.
So
you know, it almost had a jewelry effect, like finding a diamond or.
Yeah. And these were traded all over the United States. I mean, you see them as far west as the Mississippi River.
From this area.
Or at least the East Coast.
Yeah.
It gets kind of tough to know exactly where. You could figure it out.
Yeah. So those would probably be more valuable on the West Coast, maybe back in the day.
Because marine shell is it's harder to get, but it wasn't so much valuable from a coinage perspective.
Gotcha.
But think of it as a spiritual ritual, commodity or something like that.
So if they found this thing from the earth, it was just a beauty that came from the earth, and that's what they
was
part of.
And it has quality. I mean, you know, it's impossible to understand the native world view from our perspective,
but
it was very different. And you know, their world was filled with all kinds of spirits and beings and things, and you know, things that we wouldn't think were animate were to them.
Like, what are some of these things?
Rocks is a good example. I mean, we not only don't think of rock as animate, right? But you take a couple of cobbles of quartz and you smack them together at night, sparks fly.
Wow.
You know, that's a very powerful substance and material.
Yep.
So a lot of things like that, which we normally wouldn't consider animate, are. Okay. And, you know, you need to negotiate that world every day. You know, don't piss anybody off. Make sure you're doing the right thing in the right way. When you're hunting, when you're gathering, when you're doing this, make sure you give back an offering in the right way. Very complicated world.
Hey, but if you take the vast religions that exist today, if you try to view them all, it's complicated.
It's very complicated.
Wait a minute. This religion says I can't do this or this. This religion says I have to do this. And again, it is complicated. You know, whether it be Jewish or Catholic or you know, any of them. You know,
I mean, look, there's some people who believe there's a guy with a magic guy with a beard that flies around in the sky.
Wait a minute.
Some book that he wrote. I don't know.
Oh yeah.
So that doesn't sound crazy though.
No.
Can we stay on this track for a second with that? Because I'm interested in this part, the spiritual part and the spiritual realm, the world, what they believed in, what they saw, because I believe in that world, and what are some of the spirits that they would like their, what was their main, did they have one main deity or one main, or were there?
There were a couple of important ones.
Yeah.
There was one they referred to as Kontantawit.
Okay.
He was a very kind of a benign, if you were an English person trying to define who he was, you might call him their main god, but that's a very poor choice of words.
Yep.
And that's, you know, when Native people used to pass away, they would journey to Katantuit's house in the Southwest. Southwest is a very important direction. That's where Katantuit lives. That's where their corn came from in the ear of a crow. In August, Perseus meteor showers that go to the Southwest. Those are the souls of all the people who have died the previous year. Huh. So there's, you know, these directions are important.
Yeah.
The beings that, you know, are directly involved with these things are important. And those beings are not always friendly to each other either. There's constant battling between, again, I hesitate to use good and evil, but, you know, so.
The forces, the energies.
The forces, you know, the Thunderbird is a very powerful and important being who rules the sky world.
Yep.
The underwater world is ruled by the underwater panther, who can be kind of a bad guy. He's you got to be careful with him.
Yeah.
You don't want to be going into the underwater world without being a, you know,
true believer.
Prepared and, you know, trained. And when they fight, that's what thunder and lightning is all about, right?
Yep.
And when they fight, it rains quartz. They think this is why quartz is probably a really, really important material and substance. They referred to quartz as thunderstones. And their belief was, you know, these were the result of these interactions or battles between the Thunderbird and, you know, which is probably why they're pretty powerful. And that when you smack quartz together and the sparks fly, it's lightning, right?
Wow.
So, and they're crystals.
And crystals are important. Yeah, and they're crystals. They're crystalline. White, reflective, positive, much like the marine shell.
Yep. So, huh, right.
Wow. I wonder if those, you know, if one group believes more strongly in one than another, and maybe that's how some
that was my next question. Are these deities, how far do they extend to the local tribe, or do they vary from tribe to tribe, or was it, you know, a more widely spread belief?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. It's pretty widely spread among the Eastern Woodlands peoples, but there's a lot of variations.
Variations on, yeah.
But there's a similarity in, you know, worldview and belief systems that you can see across, you know, a good portion of the continent. I hesitate to say that because I don't want anybody to think that, you know, we think of Native people as homogeneous culture and, you know, they're not different, they're all the same. And that's, you know, clearly not the case.
Right.
But they did share probably from a distant past when they were sharing a lot because there are fewer of them perhaps, or they were in the same place before they began to move apart. So they do carry some of these same, you know, basic beliefs in certain aspects of their universe.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Wow.
You me? Okay.
Go. Sorry.
So I'm going to rewind now a little bit.
We have so many questions.
Yeah, we're never going to get through.
I know,
this.
We won't get through.
He's going to be like, can I please go? So you take us through. So there's something I see once in a while, and I'm interested in the process that gets you there. And I think we touched on a little bit, and then where it goes from there. At what point in the process, down the neck, for example, a house was going to be built. It was probably 50 yards from the salt estuary. And
could try.
Yeah, no, not really. And I see that it's been boxed off. A grid's been created. Is it a grid? Is that what they call it? Okay.
Yep.
I'm assuming at that point a permit was taken and somebody from the surveyor said, this is probably a good site to go through before we let them dig it up. And then they formed the grid.
We formed the grid first.
Oh, before the decision is made.
So the decision is made, we want to build a house here.
Okay.
So they apply for a permit, and that permit goes to the town and to Coastal Resource Management, and they look at the property. And I know the one you're talking about.
Yeah.
And they said, well, you're within 200 feet of the coast. You're going to need an archaeological survey. And we did that survey, found some really interesting and important things, material. So important that everybody is reluctant to, like, dig them up. So this is where it gets, you know, conversations with the Narragansetts, with the engineers, with the architects, with the archaeologists. How can we do a redesign that would allow these people to use their land? And nobody doesn't want them. We want them to use it. It's not a good precedent.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You want to work with them rather than become the enemy.
Exactly.
Yeah, because with the enemy, you get nowhere. Yeah, yep. Okay.
And the decision was made that, you know, we're going to put the house on pylons. We're going to raise it above. So the only impacts would be where those holes were going to be dug.
Minimal intrusion.
Yeah, and we took the design and we moved it around a little bit to make sure that it didn't impact any. And they figured it, they fit it in, and we were able to build a house.
That's cool. That's really cool. A great compromise, actually.
So the purpose of the grid is to keep track of areas you're sampling?
Yeah, we need to know where things came from within inches.
Now, who typically comes out to assist with that? Is it students of archaeology? Is it all archaeologists? Is it a mix of both, volunteers?
It you know, I have been bringing my students out there for a long time, but, you know, the reality is you really need to get professional archaeologists out there who want to be paid, and they'll work quickly and efficiently in their experience. So it costs money. People are a little more reluctant to place too much of a burden on a private landowner, especially if it's not a subdivision. You know, it's like somebody just wants to build a house. So we're, you know, usually cognizant of that. I would bring out unpaid students and volunteers to offset that as much as possible.
So some of this cost falls on the property owner.
Oh, yeah.
Because obviously it's a hoop they got to jump through to get their property built the way they want.
Where do you find an archaeologist? Like on Craigslist?
Yeah, you can find them anywhere.
There's really?
There are more archaeologists right now than you can imagine. Yeah,
I've never had to.
Because there's so much of this. There's so much of this work going on.
Wow.
His number was on the bathroom wall at Finn's.
Is that how we got this interview? I was wondering. I knew
that would work. I took it there years ago.
Got bones? Call Kevin.
Pre-COVID. Find some pre-COVID stuff. What were you just talking about?
I don't know, the grid and, you know, that whole process.
Oh, I know what I wanted to ask you. What's the coolest thing you've ever found where you're like,
Boy, that's
ever.
So hard. There's so many cool things.
Couple cool things.
It is tough. It's like, you know, I'm going to relate it to, like, I record a guest and I think that's, oh my God, I learned so much. That was so much fun. It's my favorite podcast. 2 weeks later, whatever, you record another one, and you're like, it's amazing. So it must be like that.
Let me ask a more general question. When did you get the archaeology bug?
Yeah, let's talk about you. Let's talk about you for a second.
Yeah. Let's get to know
That's
Kevin.
That's good. I think it's
Let's get
time.
To know Kevin yeah, McBride, it's time. The it's man.
Time. You just tell us. Let's move on.
Yeah. Yeah. It's about me.
It's about you. It is. Yeah.
Well, you know, I was always in history, as we all are, right? Most of us. And I kind of vaguely knew what archaeology was, but not really. And I graduated from college. I had no clue about anything.
What did you study in college? You didn't study that?
History.
History, okay. Yeah.
And, you know, so I spent a couple of years wandering aimlessly around Europe and the States. You know,
nice.
We all did the same thing, right?
Went to a couple dead shows, probably.
A lot of dead shows.
Nice.
And sometimes we waited for them to come back the next day.
Yeah. You know.
And I began to just volunteer on digs, you know, a Roman site or a, you know, Pueblo site.
Wait, did you say Roman?
Roman.
As in Rome.
In England.
He would roam around Europe and every. This was all over the world, not just the U.S.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
The dead didn't play there, probably.
Okay. No. Okay. But, yeah. Roman site, Long Hadrian's Wall.
Wow.
Over the years, I've worked on Roman sites in Portugal. But it just, it, you know, the bug got me, and it was just fascinating. It's part of the discovery process, probably a lot of the problem solving aspects of it.
Yeah.
Applied to grad school at UConn and got in. I don't know why. I was the absolute worst student. Oh my God.
How many dead shows have you been to? You're like, over 100. They're like, you're in.
Well, in those days, all you had to do was pass the mirror test. So they put a mirror under your nose.
That's it. Yeah.
You know, if there was a little
heartbeat,
little breath.
You know, Yep.
You're good. You're breathing.
That's
you're
how
good.
We started this podcast. Basically,
I sense that.
Yeah. I don't know what the hell we're doing. These guys, like, these guys don't have a clue what they're doing.
Sometimes people like it that way, though.
Yeah. So when did you discover, when were you like, I want to make that, I'm so into, when was your all in moment where you're like, I'm going to do this for my life, the
probably,
rest of my life?
Probably, you know, a couple of years after I started grad school.
It was so you're in your 20s?
Yeah, early 20s.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just said, man, this is cool stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And have you been all around the world, like everywhere?
I wouldn't go, you know, Atlantic, you know, I've worked in Portugal, I've worked in England, I've worked in Caribbean, Mexico, Baja, Mexico.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a yes.
I guess, yeah. I mean, I haven't been to the Pacific area or Eastern Europe or anything like that. But
so do you have like a preference? Do you find one area more interesting than another, like Roman versus like your Native American archaeology or...
I do have a preference, actually. And in the last 20 years, I've been doing a lot of battlefield archaeology.
Okay.
Which is pretty interesting. In fact, we did a battlefield archaeology project on Black Island.
Any particular war?
Pequot War, 1636-37. I've done King Philip's War, 1675-76. Uh-huh. I've done Rev War. I've done the War of 1812. I'm just a battlefield archaeologist for all seasons.
Wow.
And it's the ultimate challenge.
How so?
Well, you know, orienting yourself, identifying the material you're looking for, because these landscapes where the battle took place, they've been used for 400 years. And there's a lot of other crap that you got to be able to distinguish and figure stuff out. And, you know,
and there may have been battle took place there 300 years before the battle you're
and
looking
that gets
for.
Then it gets real complicated, and that happens.
I believe it.
Yeah. But, you know, so that's a really, it's sort of those projects draw in a wide range of expertise, problem-solving abilities, military experts.
When you say problem-solving, what do you mean in terms of like problems with actually digging physically the things up or like
interpreting,
in terms of that's what I meant, like connecting
interpreting
it to,
you know because most of the battles we do are there's musket balls. It's not like you're on a modern battlefield where you have forensic analysis on bullet casings and shells where you can see individual weapons and stuff like that. So you got, it's a little more nuanced, but you know, you can tell some pretty interesting things on these battlefields. And, you know, I always liked about it is we don't just, you know, find military stuff. I mean, conflict is a really important, interesting way. It's a window on a society, a culture, all aspects, technology, ideology, social organization, political organization. You know, a country's military reflects a lot about that society.
Yeah.
And that's what we try and get.
And their advancement. You know, over.
Yeah, I mean, you know what happens during military conflicts. There's a rapid advancement of technology that disseminates itself in all aspects of social life.
And were any of those what I'll call the modern day wars, being post 1700?
Yeah.
Did anything like that take place on Block Island?
Yeah.
Oh, there were skirmishes out there.
There was there's a couple of things that happened on Block Island.
Cool. I mean,
I
not for
know.
Them, but
yeah.
You know. Yeah.
I mean, the very first opening shots of the Pequot War were on Block Island.
I remember Pat talking about, sorry, go ahead, refresh our memories though.
Yeah. So, you know, the Manassees, I guess, they killed or accused of killing a traitor off the North Light. And the English decided in retaliation they were going to send 90 men.
Right.
They very dramatic amphibious landing. They go all over the island. Their orders were to kill all the men and take away all the women and children. But they had all fled to the swamps, and, you know, they kind of escaped. But, you know, we see evidence of that. You know, you mentioned metal detecting before. That's the primary tool for a battlefield survey is metal detecting. And we find, you know, we found a lot of musket balls in particular patterns, and we could sort of trace where the English were actually going and chasing, wow, you know, the native people. And then, of course, let's not forget the French pirates.
Oh.
They were a big deal. They were a big deal on Block Island.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, okay, go.
Really? Wait.
Don't just bait us. Like, I mean, I don't.
What was that?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's some pretty interesting narratives about the French would always raid Block Island. It was kind of isolated, unprotected.
1600s, 1700s,
1800s? Late 1600s, early 1700s. Yeah. And we find we're not looking for pirate stuff unless it's the loot.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we're
the
all
booty.
The booty. But do chances you, are we're not going to find that.
We're all after the booty.
Do you believe that there's a possibility there's some loot somewhere on Block Island?
Yeah, there's always a possibility, but I think that, you know.
Well, there's the old Captain Kidd myth, right?
Isn't it? Yeah.
His, up at Sands property.
Yeah.
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 I mean, it's almost, Captain Kidd is almost like George Washington slept here.
Yeah,
he
yeah.
was everywhere.
He was everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
So he wasn't French either, though, was he?
I don't know that much about him.
But why were the, go ahead.
No, no. But there's a really interesting sea battle that took place off Block Island.
Pirate sea battle with pirates?
Pirates and Stonington Borough people.
Really?
Yeah.
You know so, this?
I heard about, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's actually, you know, it's in a guy named Reverend Niles, Samuel Niles wrote about it. And, you know, the Block Islands are getting so, you know, angry at the French pirates that are constantly raiding them. And, you know, they built a fort where Fort Island is now. There used to be an Indian fort, but then they, you know, they built another fort, and, you know, they just were always getting hammered by these French pirates. So they approached Stonington, which had a pretty good fleet of merchant ships and, you know, fishing vessels. And they had these prearranged signals. The next time the pirates were around, they would, you know, notify Stonington. It was just over the, you know, just across yeah. the bay. And these guys, the Stonington guys, would come out and all armed, no cannons on either side, but they fought each other with muskets and pistols and defeated the French and captured them. And,
yeah,
you know, it was pretty dramatic.
Wow. Pretty cool. Yeah, that's really cool.
I found out about that one in, actually, I found it in Stonington when I was hanging out in the borough one day.
I just love the neighbor effect of, we'll let you right. know when they're here, like with lights yeah. or lanterns
yeah.
or
yeah.
build a big bonfire. I don't know, how would they signal them? Probably with a fire?
Fire yeah. of some sort, had to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow, that's pretty cool.
Huh. Imagine that, you're the French, but let's go get those guys, man. They're yeah. easy pickings, and yeah. then one day you roll up, and then you're like, not today.
Yeah.
Stonington's
We yeah. made friends.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
yeah.
Wow. Yeah, and well, all right. Back to you. So, you've worked with the Pequot Museum.
Yep.
Do you still yep. get called in for that?
Yep.
Is it sort
yeah,
of a,
you know,
did you ever like have an official title with them or yeah. no?
I was director of research.
You were director of research for
many, many, many years.
And now you are professor.
Well, I always was. The museum was a base for us.
Yeah.
They built us great facilities. It is an amazing place in terms of the analytical capabilities, storage, analysis, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So and we still go there. We still use it.
Up the street. Yeah, yep. Up here. Yep. How's their color? God, I'm so embarrassed. I haven't been in there yet. It's right up the street.
The
museum.
It's
impressive. I know. I got to go. It's good collection of stuff.
Yeah.
All right.
It's very good. Very, very interesting.
Up there.
So they're, you know.
And where'd you get your doctorate?
UConn.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Right. You said that.
A little incestuous.
But. It's all right.
Yeah,
it's so is Block Island.
Yeah.
Wait
a minute.
I know. And did you go back into like archaeological life? I mean, private, or were you always then in
the No, I was always university. I was always academic.
Okay.
Yeah. But I do a lot of.
Yeah. How many books you written?
I don't go for books.
Nah?
I go for articles.
Me neither.
More articles,
okay.
You know, academic journal type articles.
Did you get anything in like National Geographic?
I don't No.
No.
I don't think so.
Is that like the gold standard if you...
No.
No?
No. Yeah. No one cares about now.
Oh, look at this. Getting some archaeological like shit.
Unless they wrote an article about me.
Of course.
Being published about versus being published.
And they have over the years approached us about, you know,
and you're like,
doing a project. And we just didn't have anything that was like stunningly visual enough to.
Right. Yeah. It's all about that.
So it's fine.
That's cool. But you've been published in some.
Yeah.
Periodicals or whatever.
Yeah,
reviews.
You know, our journal, you know, our academic journals, and you know,
brag a little bit. You can brag a little bit. What's like the best one?
Probably American Antiquity, Society for Historical Archaeology, and, a bunch of them. That's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to publish so many articles a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. All that kind of stuff.
How do you like being the academic life, being a professor?
It's the best.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it, you know.
I would have no idea.
I can't. We don't know how to do that, obviously, if you haven't been able to tell.
I feel like this is the best free I'm getting with no tuition here.
There's only one prerequisite.
Yeah.
You've got to love to hear yourself talk.
Oh.
What you're going to teach.
Oh, and we should both
be
professors.
We
could be professors.
Plus, all we have to do is get those like corduroy sports jackets with the patches on the arms.
I had one of those.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah.
Told you.
Excellent. Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah, because you have, and you like take sabbaticals sometimes and then go dive back in.
Sometimes, you're teaching for, 7 months of the year or whatever. And then when you get tired of teaching because they drive you nuts, you're in the field.
Yeah.
Then when you get tired of being in the field, school starts.
Have you ever had like an ex-student that you've inspired that's gone on to do a similar thing?
Many, actually.
Oh,
and that's
really?
Probably the most rewarding thing.
That's
cool. I would bet. Yeah.
And you're in touch with some.
I'm in touch with them all the time.
Yeah.
You know, we're always still part of the network. And I pride myself on the students that,
And they'll reach out to you and say, hey, can you help me out with this one? Yeah. Or want to check this out?
You want to do a project together? That's pretty gratifying for
me. That's cool.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, we always. Not always, but we've brought it up, Mark and I, the whole, I'm going to go for it. The Settlers Rock, are they really, it's like, I don't think you were actually the settlers of Block Island. You know what I mean? And I don't want to diss any families because they are the white English settlers and those sorts of things.
That's an interesting.
Yeah. It just seems to me like, one of my enjoyable shows I watch is called Aerial America, and every single one has a 10-minute piece about how the white man came and off the Native Americans went, and that was it, Sometimes by force, sometimes by because they said, peace out, I'm getting out. But, and that's so that just happens. That happened everywhere, even on Block Island.
The history of, colonial period, all over the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Everywhere.
It's just like, part of our podcast is just pointing out the funny things about Block Island, quote unquote funny, ironic things. And it really is that like one of the big beefs that the locals have on Block Island is like, oh, the tourists, the classic locals versus the tourists that come every summer.
Coming in and building
and
houses
like,
and taking over.
Dude, you were the original tourists, guys. Hate to break it to you.
Only you killed people.
Yeah.
Well, not these settlers, but.
No, yes, we,
centuries before them.
Your tires are going to be slashed when you get home.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time. I'll be all right.
Anyway.
Yeah, well.
It's up to you. We're like,
I think we're probably have talked. Is there anything we missed over that you want to talk about or anything like that? If not, I got to say thank you. This has been a fascinating education.
Also, we've been forgetting to do lightning rounds. Have you noticed that?
I have.
Do you know what a lightning round is?
One ready.
I don't either, but I have some random questions that
I'll let you do it.
I have two lightning round questions. Last questions of the interview. Have you ever had to run away from an angry mob of people like that you've been working on their site and had poison darts blown at you and then swung across a ravine, jumped on a biplane and jumped in taken off? Only to find a snake in your lap.
Kinda.
Okay. Right. Kinda. Something. Have you really? Have you had like an Indiana Jones moments?
I've been shot at.
Oh, awesome.
Okay, hold on. This interview may not be
quite okay. Here we go.
Go ahead.
It wasn't you know, a huge deal. We were doing a survey for a highway or something, and we had permission, but, you know, we're in northeastern Connecticut, which is kind of a strange place.
Say no more.
And, you know, this family of sisters and brothers in their 70s and 80s come out, and one of them has a shotgun. And, you know, she goes, "Honey, you're real cute, but if you don't get off my land right now," and she shoots in the air.
Whoa.
I said, okay. So I wasn't really shot at. Yeah. But it makes for a good story.
Right? It sure does.
You said, looked at her and you go, "How cute." What are you doing later?
1 to 10.
All right, last question. Most memorable Grateful Dead show.
Wow. Well, I probably wouldn't remember.
Ah, great answer.
That's what I was thinking.
Ladies and gentlemen, Kevin McBride.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kevin. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you. You guys are great.
And thanks, once again, thanks to our listeners for listening. We really hope you enjoyed this episode. And you know how to reach us, please. Comments, questions, ideas. twoguysonblockisland@gmail.com.
And don't forget to follow us on all of the proper social media channels, whether it's Facebook, Instagram, yada, yada, yada. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen to it. But most importantly, if you enjoy it, just tell your friends.
That's the ticket.
That's it. Yeah. All right. Thanks again to Kevin McBride.
Thanks, Kevin. And
thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
All right. Thanks, Rich. I'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Bye. Hey, Rich.
Yeah?
Do you feel like as stupid as I do right now?
I kind of feel like I've been dumbed down. Like, you know.
No. Yeah, well, no. I feel like he was dumbing it down for us. So
I think
he
was, and
it.
I still was pretending to
know
what half of those words meant.
Oh,
so
my God.
We're getting better.
We
though.
Really
we're
need
gonna,
to
get better.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I made it all up. I'm telling you.
Later, Mark.
Bye. Oh, and one last thing. Whether you're a local or just visiting Block Island, pick up a copy of the Block Island Guide. Published annually for the last 35 years, it features 120 pages full of killer photos and all the details you need to know. Most importantly, it's fun to read. What shall we do with Shark and Sailor? What shall we do with Shark and Sailor? What shall